Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 162. First, some housekeeping. A huge thank you to all my supporters. The podcast just passed 1.3 million listens, so there's a large number of folks out there who've found the series useful. I'm so delighted that our crazy tale here on the southern tip of Africa has resonated with so many people. The response has utterly stunned me, thinking when I started that being so battered by headwinds as we are at the moment, cynicism would sink the show. But it's the opposite. To all the hundreds of people who've sent emails over the last 24 months, your personal stories and responses have been noted and stored. There's a treasure trove of stuff which I'm going to try and use where appropriate. If you'd like to contact me, please send a mail to desmondlatham@gmail.com. That's desmondlatham@gmail.com. Or you can head off to my site, desmondlatham.blog. There's a contact form there and a newsletter sign up. And now I'm back to the mid-1840s. When we left off, Moshoeshoe and Adam Cook had signed a treaty with the Cape Governor, which gave them formal power over their territories. As you know, if you've listened to episode 161, the definition of exactly what was their territory was somewhat hazy. By now, the Batlokwe, the Kurana, and the Voortrekkers, amongst others, had taken issue with this treaty, saying Moshoeshoe and Cook had no control over their people. There was also a flourishing trade across the Orange, tying Cape towns like Beaufort West and Graaf-Reinet and Grahamstown directly to the settlements to the north by these trade routes. The Griqua received their gunpowder from these towns and sold their cattle and ivory there, for example. Their lives had improved in many ways. The Griqua initially built beehive homes covered in skins. While good at keeping out the cold, they suffered in the powerful half-felt storms. So the Griqua built more permanent structures using wooden frames with a thatched roof and a floor of cow dung. Timber was a problem. They had to travel high up the Orange River and south of the Cut River in the Eastern Cape to secure their house frames. They were attuned to market forces further south, like the Boers, and the colonial smosa or hawkers often travelled from the colony in wagons to sell pots and pans, as well as cheap liquor, which irritated the missionaries. The Orange River was a significant challenge at this stage. There was no bridge or ferry, and when it flooded, weeks could pass before wagons could cross. The British presence was concentrated in Colesberg, where the civil commissioner, with the wonderfully memorable name of Fleetwood Rawstone, served for 21 years. He was subordinate to the Lieutenant Governor of the Eastern Province. Through the crucial years of the 1840s, this post was held by Lieutenant Colonel Hare, who lived in Grahamstown. After the return of Jan Kok with a C, and the Modderrivier Boers from Natal, life became more difficult for the British Commissioner. The treaty signed between the Griqua and the Cape Colony in 1843 was supposed to bring permanent peace to the Transorangia region, but was predicated on the fact that the Griqua were supposed to pacify the Boers. The Boers totally rejected that premise. Between the signing of the treaty in 1843 and the major breakdown in relations in 1845, a succession of incidents threatened to spill over into full war. In March 1844, Adam Cook arrested a Boer called Van Staden, who'd killed an Englishman called George Mills in a fight and was going to send him to Colesberg to stand trial. Cook said he was permitted to do this in terms of the Cape of Good Hope Punishment Act, but the Boers no longer believed they were part of the Cape of Good Hope. There was a mini-revolt, with Van Staden's supporters saying he could not be subjected to the jurisdiction of what they called a black man. Cook had also banned the drink that everyone called Cape Smoke, brandy, and the Boers rejected this too. They usually transferred their Cape Smoke via Philippolis, which was being administered now by Adam Cook. The brandy we drink today and that brandy were not entirely the same thing. Some called it then a coarse kind of peach. Brandy was something of the character of gin with a raisiny flavour and a very rank spirit. Jan Mok, fresh from his stint in Natal, trekked away again, this time heading to the Northern Vaal region, where he tried to negotiate a land deal with the Pedi people. He was following Hendrik Potgieter, who had also been considering the northern escape route from English interference. With Mok, the firebrand, out of town for the moment, other Boers decided they should actually negotiate with the English and the Griqua. A short conference was held in Philippolis, where Adam Cook and local Boer leaders Ob Holster and Gideon Joubert Menton agreed that the Trekkers, who'd been hostile to the British government, should lose their land they'd rented from the Griqua. Oberholster was apparently trying to rid himself of Mock, who'd been trouble since he'd arrived in the Transorangia region and had been even more radicalized after he returned from Natal. The big problem for Oberholster were the disaffected Boers, as they were known. Some of the observers at this conference, like Mock's fellow Natal returnee Young Kok, spelled K-O-C-K, could not stomach the proposal. New Cape Governor Sir Peregrine Maitland was surprised to hear about this conference, a kind of bosparat behind the back of the other Boers and the British. He didn't fully trust Griqua leader Kok, and presumed he was using this conference as a means to increase his military power. So the Transorangia region was quietly smouldering through to the end of 1844 as the Boers and the Griqua eyed each other suspiciously. Maitland had also begun to doubt the wisdom of the Napier Treaty signed with the Griqua and the Basutu. In November 1844, the Boers had enough, and a commando was assembled under Young Kok, which rode to Philippolis, where a Griqua commando had also been assembled and awaited their arrival. A Mexican standoff developed. That's defined as a confrontation where no strategy exists that allows either party to achieve victory. Just as an aside, the cliché of a Mexican standoff is best known in Westerns, and probably the most memorable would be Sergio Leone's 1966 classic, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Back to Philippolis. These were the days before the rifle. Both the Griqua and the Boers were armed with muskets, and both groups were equally gifted when it came to shooting prowess. They were also an equally sized group, and both parties knew that possible extreme bloodletting awaited. These few hundred men, Boer and Griqua, dismounted from their horses and stood less than 50 meters apart. The Boers then decided to disperse, because if this skirmish had gone ahead, the casualty rate on both sides would have been catastrophic. Hendrik Potgieter attempted to set up a face-to-face meeting with Adam Kok afterwards to sort things out. The Griqua captain said he was not at liberty to meet officially with anyone who, in his words, assumes to himself a supremacy over Her Majesty's subjects, which meant Potgieter. After a bit more to and fro, Kok agreed to let a dozen Boers into Philippolis, excluding Potgieter. I suppose we could call these the Distrustful Dozen, and they rode into Philippolis at the end of November, another distinctly Western-style event. The Distrustful Dozen handed a document to Adam Kok, which is fascinating to read. We, they meant as the Boers, are emigrants together with you, in other words, the Griquas, and are regarded as such. Of course, the Griqua were splitting images of the Voortrekkers. Wagons, hats, trousers, horses, gunpowder, muskets, language, trading techniques, and their religion. They were all Christians. Who, together with you, continued Portita's document, dwell in the same strange land, and we desire to be regarded as neither more nor less than your fellow emigrants, inhabitants of the country, enjoying the same privileges as you. Is it not remarkable that this document, which is an honest note about perceptions of belonging, shows how clearly the Trekkers believed they were equal to the Griqua, and that both were outsiders? When it came to law and order, Potgieter said the Voortrekkers didn't want to bring any local chief under their laws and authority, but allow each to follow their own authority. Another crucial moment. But in the case of any crime committed by a white against a native, Portkita's document continues, the native shall complain to the leader of the whites, and when a crime is committed by a native against a white, the white shall complain to the leader of the natives. This is future South African race relations horse trading, blunt, but already the silo of colour reinforcing to each their own. Even though the Griqua and Boer were essentially identical, if you remove the tinge of colour and a surname here and there, Portkita was still determined to separate himself. In the case of hired servants of either party absconding, they shall be mutually delivered up by both parties. Adam Kok listened to the Boers, but said that as far as he was concerned, he trusted the English government as the final arbiters of any dispute. That, of course, was not acceptable to the Trekkers, who were trying to escape English rule. They may have been almost identical, but Adam Kok's ancestors had a long-standing distrust of the Boers, going back to the Bastard and Khoisan on the farms of the interior starting in the 17th century. Anyway, the British were an empire. There was a lot more for the Griqua to gain working with the English than against the English. That attitude, by the way, was going to change fundamentally over the next few decades, as you're going to hear. Governor Maitland was deep in thought back in the Cape. He had quickly assessed the rising tension across the Orange as well as in the Eastern Cape. He was another Peninsular War vet, commanding a brigade at the Battle of Waterloo. Maitland had been part of the army that defeated Napoleon, and his bravery during that battle had brought him a formal vote of thanks from the British House of Commons. Maitland had been promoted to Commander-in-Chief of the Army in the Indian city of Madras, then spent time as Lieutenant Governor of Upper Canada, followed by Nova Scotia. But he was now 67 years old, and because of his tough military background, looked older. By the time the Cape had finished with him, he was going to be even more exhausted. While in Canada, the ex-military man had drawn sarcasm and anger for indolence and incompetence. As a deeply religious man, he believed in the freedom of black and coloured before he arrived in the Cape, but he was going to have to deal with an upcoming frontier war against the Amakhosa shortly. I'll come back to what he was up to in the Eastern Cape in a later podcast. Back in Philippolis, the confrontation over land possession along the northern banks of the Orange was about to begin. In March 1845, Adam Cork invoked his power of authority he claimed to hold under the Cape of Good Hope Punishment Act by sending a commander of armed Griqua riders to arrest Jan Cranau, a local boer who lived within the territory the British had allocated to the Griqua. Cranau was accused of intercepting two Basutu workers who were Adam Cork's subjects and forcing them to work on his farm. Cranau was tipped off about the imminent arrest and disappeared, so the commander interrogated his wife for a day instead. By all accounts, this was non-violent but aggressive, and the Boers were offended, so much so that both the Griqua and the Boers then lagered their families in preparation for what looked like a fight. Oberholzer now joined the Boers, despite his friendship with the Griqua. Fellow Griqua captain Jan Waterboer, who was living up the road in Griqua town, heard about the growing crisis and called out his commando, then rushed to the support of Adam Cork. Governor Maitland was informed of what was going on, and he ordered British soldiers to mobilise to also help Cork. On the night of the 22nd of April, 1845, Colesberg magistrate the magnificent Fleetwood Rawstone rode into Philippolis along with two companies of the 91st Regiment commanded by Major Campbell. This was good news for Adam Cork. A few sections from the 7th Dragoon Guards marched out from Fort Beaufort under Lieutenant Colonel Richardson and then crossed the Orange at Allemans Drift on the 26th of April, 1845. The British sent reconnaissance parties to scout for the Boers. At first, none were visible. The rest of the almost 200 British soldiers of the 91st marched slowly north, searching for the Boers' lager. A force of around 100 Griquas joined the British and then rode to Fisser's Hook, 40 kilometres north of Philippolis. It was late in the afternoon of the 30th of April that a recon patrol found the Boers' main fighting lager at Swartkoppies, almost 10 kilometres away from Fisser's Hook, just northwest of the main road. A larger group of Boers, including their women and children, were 15 kilometres further north at Tofontein. The landscape here is typical of the southern Free State, rolling grasslands and a range of small stony hills which run southeast to northwest near Swartkoppies. The lager there was located between two ridges, and on the eastern side, the Boers had set up a 3-pounder gun. They were ready for action. Jan Cock, who commanded the Boers, had not sent out patrols and was unaware that a British force was so close. That didn't last long. As the Griquas and men of the 91st Regiment approached, 250 Boers rode out and began to fire long-range shots at the approaching Griquas, who'd split up from the 91st and were riding into the lager from the southeast. The Griqua commander turned and galloped across the front of the troops of the 91st, Cock's commander in full pursuit. Richardson ordered his cavalry to outflank Cock on his right, and the Boer commander then thought better of continuing, swinging their horses about and heading back into their lager at Swartkoppies. It was the first time the Boers had witnessed British cavalry, and it was a shock. The Dragoon Guards galloped towards the 3-pounder cannon, shooting the gunner. The rest of Cock's men spotted the glinting cavalry swords and hurried back into their defensive positions. But the Boers had made a big mistake by leaving their women and children so close, One of the companies of dragoons made a beeline for the Tweefontein Lager, where 400 civilians were hiding, and seized it that night, virtually without a shot being fired. The entire force, including the Griquas, who'd captured a large herd of cattle by now, surrounded the Boers' fighting lager at Swartkoppies. Everyone held their fire. 10 Boers had already died, along with one British soldier and 2 Griqua. The battle was formally over. A few days later, on the 3rd of May, another large unit of British soldiers arrived at Philippolis ahead of Sir Peregrine Maitland, who decided to go and see the trouble for himself. Most of the voortrekkers now scattered after the Battle of Swartkoppies, heading towards Winbach on Basutoliede Moshoeshoe's northern flank. Maitland held a meeting with the Griqua and other local black leaders, along with the Trek Boers who remained behind within the territory up to the limit of the Cape of Good Hope Punishment Act, a line that followed latitude 25 degrees south. The new governor, for all his faults, was fully aware of how the chaotic conditions across the Orange could upend his administration. His great purpose, as he told the Secretary of State in a letter at the time, was to secure their lands and freedom to the numerous native tribes inhabiting the country for hundreds of miles beyond the colony to the northeast against the encroachment and aggression of self-expatriated British subjects. By self-expatriated British subjects, he meant voortrekkers. They preferred voortrekker, or perhaps emigrant farmer or boer, but definitely not self-expatriated British subjects. How could the governor manage all of this when he was struggling to control the farmers inside the colony who were tussling with the Amakhosa? Maitland thought he had an answer. He'd lived in Canada and knew that individual treaties with principal chiefs was one way to acknowledge their sovereignty, define boundaries, divide territories. These lands would be clearly divided into 2 parts. First, for the indigenous people, where no trekker would be permitted to own land, and the second, where the chief would be allowed to lease land to the self-expatriated British subjects. Each community, Griqua, Black and Boer, would have complete control over their affairs, but disputes between the trekkers and the other groups would be settled by a magistrate. These magistrates would deploy the Cape of Good Hope Punishment Act. Any land rent paid by the trekkers would be divided equally between the chiefs and the government. Both the chiefs and the trekkers would also be on a call to arms when ordered by the Cape government. This was a frontier, after all. What about Moshoeshoe, who had railed against the Batlokwa, Sekonyela's people, amongst others, and the Griqua, who he said were now squatting on his land, and ditto the Trek Boers? Around 300 different families were now living on land along the Caledon River he said was his. The longer they stayed, the more at home they felt. Maitland presented this plan to the Griqua chiefs Kok and Waterboer, as well as the chiefs of the Caledon Basin, including Moshoeshoe, on the 30th of June 1845. The meeting was held at the former Boer camp of Tweefontein, which was actually inside Kok's territory. Maitland informed Moshoeshoe that he did not have the capacity at this stage to resolve the dispute with the Wesleyan missionaries who denied Moshoeshoe owned Batlokwa land. The French missionary Casali was sitting alongside Moshoeshoe when Maitland made this announcement. Moshoeshoe had a decision to make. The idea of sharing his land was anathema, but he didn't want to damage relations with this powerful British government. He knew that if he handed some of his valuable land along the Orange Caledon Valleys to the trekkers, it would pass irrevocably into white hands, and worse, in some ways, it would mean a failure to ensure recognition of his sovereignty over the country occupied by chiefs like Moroka, Taibosh, Davids, and Baiki. So, like all good diplomats, he split the difference, accepting the principles of the idea, while stating that he did not waive any sovereignty over his land. A new boundary was reset. Trek Boers could lease land in the Orange Caledon Triangle, extending roughly 50 kilometers east from the junction of the two big rivers to Buffalo's Flay. That's where the town of Aliwal North is today. The line would extend to Kumisi Drif on the Caledon River itself. While at the gathering, Taung chief Moletsane had spoken with Moshoeshoe and said he wished the land he occupied around the Paris mission station at Mkwatleng to be included in Moshoeshoe's territory. Adam Kok accepted a similar arrangement. Who was going to apply this new territorial law? Maitland ordered a government official to be based much further north on a farm called Bloemfontein. Because the British were now proclaiming themselves in charge of land north of the Orange, They needed representatives deep in the territory that was still unnamed, but would eventually be known as the Free State. The British resident at Bloemfontein would settle disputes, punish evildoers, as they called it, and act as an intermediary between the Trekkers, Griqua, and African groups there, as well as the British government. The first man delegated to head off to Bloem resigned before he could arrive, but the second, Henry Douglas Warden, was to have a major effect. He would also be immortalized in the Free State with a town that still bears his name, Warden. Maitland needed the Voortrekkers to buy into his scheme and sent a colonial Afrikaner official field commandant, Gideon Jobe, to encourage his fellow Trekkers beyond the Orange River to cooperate. Maitland told Jobe to negotiate terms with Moshoeshoe and the other chiefs of the region. But by the time Jobe reached the Caledon Basin, he'd already spent an acrimonious week among the Trekkers, who were venomously anti-British. They refused to submit to Maitland's land rent scheme. They bluntly wanted to be recognized as owners of the land they were on. His mission was rife. When he spoke to Moroka, Taibosh, Baki, and Davids, they said if the British government recognized them as independent from Moshoeshoe, they would accept the Trekkers' land claims northwest of the Caledon below Sekonyela's territory. That was not going to be easy. Jobe rode on to Moshoeshoe, who told him bluntly that Moroka and the other chiefs were his subordinates and that no land was available for rent to the Trekkers. The Basutu king also said he had now decided to move the southern point of white occupation in the Orange Caledon Triangle from Biffle's Point, or Aliwal North, to the Kraai River. That was a much bigger problem. Jobe compiled a confidential report shortly for Maitland's eyes only. He recommended that the government make separate treaties with Moroka and the other chiefs, regardless of what Moshoeshoe had said. His logic was clear. If the government didn't do this, then the almost 300 Trekker families on 72 farms in the Orange Caledon Valley would have to move out of the land they believed they'd been given by Moshoeshoe. So to divide and rule. This was the nub of Jobe's recommendations. I also think that if Moshoeshoe become chiefs over all, he means Moshoeshoe, and the others begin to become content with it, he will become exalted, and he will be a dangerous, troublesome neighbour over the government, continued Jobe. But if it remains under various chieftainships, he will not easily become powerful. Commandant Gideon Joubert's original Dutch report of 1845, number 2828, can be found in the Cape Archives, along with the English version, which is riddled with translation errors, just by the way. Meanwhile, Hendrik Potgieter and Jan Mok and their followers had given up on the Transorangia and trekked off north. The Venda and other peoples living near the Limpopo River were about to receive uninvited visitors. What happened next is for next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. It helps elevate the visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm going to load an update about this episode. You can email me from there too. Until next, tot ziens.